You're listening to the Hope Shot Recovery Podcast.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Hope Shot. Hope you guys had a great weekend as always. Yeah, Caesar, will you read that clarity statement?
All right. The Hope Shot Clarity Statement. We here at the Hope Shot are a group of people in recovery spreading inspiration. We come from all different walks of life and pathways of recovery. Our verbiage may be different at times, but we all have one thing in common. Recovery is a lifestyle. We support all pathways of recovery. It doesn't matter how you get from A to Z, just get there. And thank you for being a part of our Hope Shot family.
Thank you, Caesar. You're getting better at that too, by the way. All right, everybody, we have a special guest tonight. We have Mary Beth, which she is, it's a funny story. So I like to steal stuff from TikTok. I'm guilty, sorry, but that's how the internet works, is we like to steal stuff from other platforms and put it on the next platform. That's just what it is, especially videos. So like, when you're busy, I don't know who has time to make videos, but that's all they do. If you're a content creator and you're just making videos, that's all you do. I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah.
But her video was, it was moving. It was touching. She got back. I'm going to let her tell the story of it, but I'm going to give you my perspective. She got out of prison and her daughter was just screaming, like bloody murder. Like she just like so happy and excited that to see mom home. And that's the gifts of recovery right there. And it's like, it affects everybody around us. We're either spewing that negativity or spewing positivity, and it goes all the way around. And that was such an emotional video. And I had to share it on our page, and it got 200,000 views on our page from that video. She seen it and hit us up and was like, "Hey, that's me."
That's me.
I'm like, all right, man. Thank God for the internet, because we never have a conversation. So I'm glad we stole the video, and I'm glad that we can link up and get your story out there. So thank you for coming on.
For sure. Yeah. Glad to be here.
Me too. And we start with everybody. Where did it all begin? How did you get to this point right here and reaching out for your video on the internet and coming on the podcast?
Yeah. Like you said, my name is Mary Beth. I am from Arkansas. I am from a small town here in Arkansas. I wasn't always from here though. So I like to really hit it from the very beginning, because people don't really understand, like when they think of the disease of addiction, right? Nobody ever stops to think what led to a person getting to where they are. Like, how did we get here? And people don't understand, like weed was not a gateway drug for me. It was not alcohol. It was trauma. You know what I'm saying? Like it was trauma. And I was young. My dad was in the military, and my parents, they could not get along to save their life. And I moved from state to state so much. I lived in 6 or 7 states before I was even in second grade. So I was that kid who, like, I just wanted somebody to pay attention to me. I wanted somebody to notice that I was even there. And it did not matter to me what kind of attention that I was getting. But it mattered if it was good attention, if it was bad attention, whatever I could get, I was taking it, because my parents were so consumed in the reality that they were living. And that was just chaos. Like chaos was normal for me. I was really young the first time I ever put a substance in my body. I think I was like 8 or 9 years old. And my dad used to smoke cigarettes. So when you're a kid and you're not thinking, like, I just see him smoking these cigarettes. And he would like smoke half a cigarette and leave it on the porch. And so I remember one day we were there by ourselves and I was like, I'm going to smoke that. And he came home and, of course, I reek. And I don't even realize it. And he's like, who smoked the cigarette? And I'm like, I don't know. And he's like, let me smell your hands. Yeah, let me smell your hands. And so, of course, it was me. I'm the culprit. And so he was like, I'm going to teach you a lesson. And we're talking like the early 90s. And he's like, you're going to smoke the rest of these cigarettes in this pack, so that way you never smoke again. But truly, I think by the time I was done, like, I knew how to smoke the cigarette. You know what I mean?
Did they think that was going to work? I don't understand the thinking behind it. Like, nowadays, I'm like, I would never do that.
Never. Yeah, but you're talking like the early 90s. And so, you know, nobody really talked about the disease of addiction. Nobody talked about what would happen if you continue to do these things in your life, what that would look like. And so I smoked those cigarettes and I liked it. At first I was sick, but then I was like, hey, this is cool. But the chaos continued. They could not stay together. They could not make it work. And there was a lot of infidelity and a lot of emotional abuse and verbal abuse, some physical abuse. So that was normal for me. And I didn't know how to deal with my feelings. Like, I didn't know, like, I could go talk to somebody because he's military. And so we were always taught as kids, just buckle up, shut up and move on. You know what I mean? Like, you don't, there's no crying in baseball, right? So there's no crying in this. Like, this is grown up business. Don't worry about it. But the whole time, like, we're affected. And so I sought out anything that I could to make me feel different. So I think I was like 12 the first time I ever drank. And by the time I was 13, I had tried my drug of choice, you know, and it just started to spiral from there. I don't know where you got, where you're from, but like, so in Arkansas and small towns in general, like if you're not in a field dying of alcohol poisoning on the weekend, like, what are you doing with your life as a kid? You know what I mean? Like, that was fun for us, but it was more than just fun for me. It was my escape from reality. And by the time I was like 13 or 14, I was in full-blown active addiction. I also come from a family. They have a very religious background. My grandfather was like a Southern Baptist preacher. So, you know, these kind of things were not talked about like in public. Like whatever happens in our family, like stays in our family. We have this reputation to uphold. She's going to grow out of it. What are you doing? You need to discipline her. Like that was their response to like emotional damage that was going on inside of me, you know, get your life together. And I mean, I'm a kid, like who knows how to get their life together when they're 13?
It's like, I feel like everybody is like the chaos is normal. You know, everything is normalized with the chaos. And that's why we're so comfortable in it, because we're literally brought up in the chaos and you don't talk about it. You know, you don't talk about Bruno. You don't talk about Bruno. No, I'm just kidding. I have kids, whatever. But yeah, they sweep it under the rug generation is what you want to call it. Sweep it under the rug generation. We don't talk about it. We don't let it out. We just have to bottle it up. That doesn't work. And you talked about trauma before. It's unprocessed trauma that we're dealing with here.
Yeah. And that's how I dealt with it. Whenever I would get high or I would get drunk, like that was my escape from reality. Like for that split moment in time, like I had no worries. I did not have to worry about my parents arguing and fighting. I didn't have to worry about not feeling loved or wanted. Like I felt amazing. And when I finally found my drug of choice and truly like, I don't really like to talk about like what exactly was the drug or choice, because that takes away from like the whole message. But the first time that I got high, I can remember feeling like I had arrived. You know what I mean? Like I had this sense of euphoric happiness. Like here I am. This is what I needed my whole life. I remember telling myself that, like, where has this been my whole life? Like I can function, like I'm happy and I was motivated and I was getting my schoolwork done and I was here for it. Not even realizing like the years of self-destruction that were ahead of me. And it was years. Eventually the unmanageability started to happen. Like I was skipping school. I was getting high before school. I was getting high during school because now I'm chemically dependent and now I've got a habit to function, and I was declining quick. I look back on those years and I'm just like, how do you do that to your kids? Like as a parent, right? Cause I have kids now and I'm like, I could never watch my kids decline like that and just sit back and be like, something's going to change and they're going to grow out of this. Like I couldn't do that. I couldn't do it. But I guess whenever you're uneducated and you don't have the resources, like I guess they were doing the best with what they could at the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what I always chalk it up to. It's the best they had at that time.
Yeah.
Because if not, then I'd probably sit on it for too long like I have. And that's what kept me sick for so long, you know?
Yeah.
What was wrong with them? We know what was wrong with them. But imagine, look at the resources we have nowadays.
Yeah, we have. It's a day of digital social media. You can't find something on the internet or social media, like you're living under a rock. But back then, like that wasn't a thing. Like you were rich if you had a computer. I'll never forget the first computer we had. Whenever the dial-up internet, it was like, I think my parents bought it with like our income tax money, and that was the coolest thing ever. But even then, you have AOL, and that was it. They didn't know where to go for those resources. But like I said, the disease of addiction started to just tear apart my life. I was 16 years old. And I remember my dad had finally divorced. My mom had divorced. And his new wife was like his new thing. And he always had, he's deceased now, so we won't just like go into a lot of detail. But he was with this woman and it was his world. And I remember I decided I was going to Memphis in May And it's like this big festival that happens in Memphis, and it's a couple hours from here. And when you're a kid, I'm like, I'm going to take his truck because his truck has way more gas than my car. And that way I have more money to go do what I want to do. But truly, that's probably what saved my life, because I was coming back home, and after a weekend of partying, I fell asleep at the wheel and I hit an 18-wheeler doing 80 miles an hour, and I never hit my brakes one time.
Dang. You know,
never hit them one time. And I literally woke up like probably 20 feet before I hit him. And that started a whole different addiction in my life. We were talking the early 2000s, and that's when Big Pharma has popped on the scene. That's when they were saying, these are not addictive. You're okay. These are life-changing. Yeah, life-changing is the word.
You got that right.
Yeah, changed the whole course of my life. I think at that point, though, I had lost every motivation in my life to do something different. I graduated high school that year in a wheelchair because I was broken. Like, my legs were broken. My body was broken. And I had no more ambition. None. Zero.
Yeah, that would take a toll on you, especially. And then on top of that, having oxys and roxys in your system. And then it's just, it's a whirlwind of destruction. You're cooped up in a wheelchair. You're broken inside. You're broken all the way around. You already have the traumas of before. Yeah. And now you're getting fueled by your addictions being fueled.
Yeah. If it wasn't meth or if it wasn't oxys, what was it? That was it. But I started to heal. My body started to heal. And that is really it. Right after graduation is when the course of my life completely changed. So I met this guy, and he was a drug dealer, and he's the one who taught me like the ways of the game. Like, he's the one who taught me how to make money. And now we have a whole new addiction, right? Like, now I'm not, the drugs are cool. Yes. But now I know how to make money. And that was my motivation. That was all my motivation. If it wasn't a trap house, if it wasn't a hotel room, that's where I lived for the next couple of years, place to place. And for any of the listeners who are listening, who've lived that life, they know what I mean. Like, you never stay any place longer than 2 or 3 days, because if you do, the police are going to come kick your door in. We're moving and we're shaking. And that's all I knew for a while. He eventually got locked up, and I was 18 years old. This is another thing, right? So like, anybody who's in active addiction, we can laugh about this stuff now, but like, you meet somebody, you fall in love, and you're like in this full-blown like living situation that is crazy in like a month. You know what I mean? Like, you're inseparable. And that's how all the relationships were in my life right at that time were. Like, I was latching on to anybody who either one had what I wanted or could fuel what I was needing to do. And then that was it. And at 18 years old, I met my oldest son's father. I think we were together for 3 months, and I was pregnant. And at that moment in my life, I can remember telling myself, I quit doing everything. Like, I quit selling drugs, I quit using drugs. And I told myself, I'm going to be the baby to this mom that I didn't feel like I had. I'm going to love this kid like my parents never loved me. And I did that. Like, I cleaned myself up. But I'm going to tell you something, like, people need to understand, there is a huge difference between clean time and recovery. It's a huge difference. You know what I mean? Like, I was just dry. And that was how I functioned for the longest time while I was pregnant with him. I could remember being so arrogant to say, like, those people, do you see how easy that is? Like, I quit doing drugs and everything. Like, I'm not addicted. You know what I mean? Like, I was so arrogant. I was like, anybody can do this. Like, it's not a thing. Like, I completely changed my life. And I guess I did at that moment. I was in school and I was working 2 full-time jobs, and I was doing what I was supposed to do to be a good mom to this kid. No, but this is something that nobody ever really talked about back then either. And that's postpartum depression. Mm. I'm an addict. I'm full of trauma. And now I'm a teenager having a baby, and I didn't know what to do with him. I can remember looking at him and thinking, like, I want to give him back. And I didn't realize, like, I was going through so much postpartum depression that I thought I was going crazy. So it wasn't shortly after he was born, probably like 6 months, I told myself, like, I'm going to start getting high again, but just on the weekends, right? Like, I'm going to get high just on the weekends, and I'm going to get caught up on the housework. I'm going to get back on my schoolwork. And I mean, it was probably 3 or 4 months of doing that before I was back in full-blown active addiction. back to the grind. That's all I knew.
Yeah, it's funny how we can talk ourselves into the delusion, right? Because it is a delusion that we aren't. You know, I think I did that for so long, is I talked myself out of thinking I was an addict. I never wanted to admit I had an alcohol problem because my dad was an alcoholic and I want to be like that guy.
Right. You
know, so these things that we talk ourselves out of, and then we try, after we talk ourselves out of it, we're like, hey, you know what? Pat myself on the back. I'm going to do all these good things. And we're thinking drugs can actually have a positive influence on our lives. Yeah. And I'm going to catch up on all kinds of stuff. And I'm going to, let's get it.
Yeah.
And then it leaves us exactly in the same place we were, if not worse.
It's every time I got worse and worse. But truly, I was in active addiction for 17 years. And at that time, that was the longest amount of sobriety that I had, was whenever I was pregnant with him. And then those first like 6 or 7 months of his life. Because very quickly now, my justifications of let me get high so I can accomplish the things I need to accomplish. Now I'm like, let me stay away, because now I'm doing all this dirt and I don't want to bring this home to my kid. And I can remember so many nights of like him playing, and I would occupy him so I could dip out and go do what I did. And eventually that turned into, I just didn't come home. Those are the hard things that it took me a while, whenever I got clean, that I could start talking about it, because there's so much more stigma behind addiction and kids and how that looked. But I told myself, like, if I ever truly want to heal, like, I have to be completely honest about it. And when I could finally start getting honest about the things I was doing as a parent and how it was affecting them, that's whenever the true healing process started to begin. I could no longer like point this finger at my parents and be like, they were such horrible parents, because now I was this horrible parent. He was not even a year old and I was back to selling drugs. And that's what I did. I justified it in my mind. Like, his grandparents were around, his dad was there, he was safe. And as long as he was safe, like, I could do what I did. And it went on like that for years until I got pregnant again. I look now back at my kids and I have no regrets, right? Like, I have no regrets, because I feel like these kids happened in my life, man, and they're the most beautiful things ever, but it was not the time nor the place to be having it. And I got pregnant with my daughter. And I would love to tell you that I was this righteous parent like I was with him, right? And that I quit doing the drugs and I got my life together again. But the disease of addiction is so sick that I couldn't stop doing what I was doing when I was pregnant with her. Mm. I didn't even know that I was pregnant with her for probably the first 4 months that I was pregnant with her. And I continued to use. You know, I continued to use and I continued to sell drugs all throughout my pregnancy. She didn't get prenatal care, right? The disease of addiction is so sick that I can remember whenever I was going into labor, and because I had a C-section before with him, I knew I was going to have another one. But like, I didn't want to leave my drugs at home. Because what happens when you leave all your stuff at home and you dip it out for a little while? Somebody's going to rob you. Somebody's about to kick my door in. And I can remember packing up my stuff, my drugs, my money, and my guns in a case to take with me to the hospital to deliver this baby. And I did. And it went with me to the hospital. And then I had her. And that's the little girl that you saw in the video. By the grace of God, like, and it's only by the grace of God that she was born healthy. Like, she was born healthy and she was beautiful. But at that moment in my life, like, life was so chaotic. I was not in any capacity ready to take care of her. I was with another guy that always works like that too, right? So like, as an addict in recovery who's worked a program, I have learned to look at like how codependency has played a role in my life. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, how I have just as much codependency issues as I do anything else. But the guy I was with at the time, he was involved in a shooting and he was out on bond. And I'll never forget, I remember being at my house and, you know, when you're high, right? Like, you always like think everybody's after you anyway, like you're super paranoid. The feds are everywhere. The police are everywhere. The super paranoia. But the place that I lived at the time was like, it was a predominantly Black neighborhood. And I remember sitting there watching these two white people walking a dog around the block. And I remember thinking like, I know I'm high, but this is not fit. You know what I mean? Like, they have this golden retriever and this is not the area that they're supposed to be in. And I had a friend of mine take her and leave with her that night because I just didn't feel right. And it was the very next day that the U.S. Marshal Service came knocking on my door because they had a warrant for his arrest because he had missed court. And we took him on a high-speed motorcycle chase. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I guess that one time, probably one time, paranoia worked.
You know? One time, but I was right.
Yeah, and all the other times, peeping out the peephole, blind stuff, none of that ever. Feds never came, but finally, one time it actually worked. I've never heard a story like that. So
yeah, and one time it actually worked, and you know, once again, we're living this life of crime that we had this motorcycle parked in my kitchen. And because like at any given time, like we knew we had to move and we had to shake. And so the motorcycle was actually parked in the kitchen. And I can remember that day of like saying our goodbyes. We hop on this motorcycle, we open up the side door and we take off like through the carport. And they literally have my house surrounded and we drove right through them. And then they chased us. And I remember looking at the court documents later on. They said that they ended up hitting us head on. And they said that we hit them. And I was like, no, we did not. Like, we did not hit you. You hit us. But that's fine. That's your story to tell. But at the time, he had a body attachment warrant for his arrest when he was indicted on federal charges. It wasn't like a day or two after that. My parents, they stepped in and they got an ex parte order, emergency ex parte order, and took custody or attempted to take custody of her. But I went on the run with her. I can't even begin to tell you my thought process on that. I look back even now like, what was I thinking? You know what I mean? Like, I have this baby, I have these drugs, and like, yeah, like, this is a good idea. Let's go on the run.
Hey, you weren't thinking. That's the thing. Yeah. Our minds are so clouded, our stinking thinking. It's like, you ain't taking what's mine. You ain't taking what's mine. It's just like the drugs. Like, that's that codependency as well. And it can filter out to all areas of our lives. And I love how you said codependency was your biggest drug, because I feel like as human beings, we all are a lot like that with the codependency in an unhealthy way, because I feel there's good healthy codependency.
Right.
But yeah, I feel like all of us take that codependency to a whole nother level because of self-worth and traumas and all these things and not worthy and all that. And then it all filters out through our life. So I think that's why the attachment to your daughter's like, you ain't taking what's mine.
Yeah.
And our thinking, it's like, I'm going to go like Bonnie and Clyde type stuff and I'm going to run across the United States.
Yeah. And not only that, though, I look back on it and I was like, for me to give custody and thought just to hand her over was me admitting defeat. Mm-hmm. Right. So like, I mean, that would be me saying I have a problem. And at that point in my life, I'm trying to fix, manage, and control everything in my life. And I don't care how much you're looking from the outside and you can see that this is unmanageable. Like, I thought I was holding it together. Like, it's so crazy to think about it now, because obviously I was not. But in my mind at the time, like, I was like, no, I'm going to make this right and I'm going to fix this. But they eventually caught me and I still wasn't willing to give her up. But then the cops were like, you don't give her to. Like, she's no longer... She's the ward of the state right now. And if you don't give us this baby, we're about to charge you with kidnapping. And it was just crazy. And so in my mind, I was like, there's no other out at this point. And so I had my friend come bring her, and my parents took custody of her at that point. And I talk about this, and I want people to understand this too. Like, and I tell the clients here at the rehab that I work at and stuff, I'm like, you can never, ever get clean in hopes of like for your kids, right? Like, I can't get clean for this man or this woman. I cannot get clean from my parents. Like, when the day that you decide to do something different with your life, it's because you're sick and tired of you. Like, you have to know inside of yourself, like, that you love yourself enough to do something different. Because my parents gave me every opportunity at that moment. Go to rehab, right? Get your life together and you can have your kids back. But as addicts, right? Like, manipulation was an art I had perfected. But like, it was... it was an art I had perfected. I knew how to fabricate these certificates from the rehab. I knew how to beat drug analysis tests, hair follicle tests. I knew how to pass all of these things. So now it's like I tell the clients here and I'm like, please understand, I wrote the book on this. You know what I mean? Like, you are never going to get it over on me. I promise you, do not let this... fool you.
You thought we were slick. I think we all been down that road. Now it's a little different from back in the day, because I was doing drug tests back in 2013. I think it was 2012. I was in drug court. And I think it was way before that when they had those tests. But anyways, I used to freaking have fake pee. I heat it up to a certain temperature. I have it on my leg strap, ready to go. Like, I thought I was slick. And I always share this about this too. And I all the time is the only person I was really getting over on is myself.
Exactly.
The whole damn time. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm faking all these tests. I'm producing these fake meetings. She said, I didn't even know what a meeting was. I just remember I had a friend who had a DHS case. She's like, you need to go to meetings. And I'm like, I don't even know what those are. Like, what kind of meetings? She's like, here, give me the sheet. And so she knew somebody who was chairing these meetings who was still high. It was crazy. And they would forge these meeting sheets for me. And I can remember, like, I'm going through these court battles. It's just like, my mom has both of my kids at this point. And like, something inside of me, I think that might have been one of those times, like, I truly had a God moment. What are you doing? You know what I mean? Like, even if you were to get custody of these kids back, what are you doing? What are you going to do with them? And one of those last hair follicles that I remember, like, I did not do my little tricks to beat it. And I went and I took it. And, of course, I failed. And that was like, it was almost like a relief, right? Because I had been putting on this facade this whole time of like, I'm this good mom. I'm doing all these things. And I gave her custody of my kids. But that was probably one of the most defining moments in my life, because as an addict, right? Like, we look for these permissions. Like, we give ourselves these permissions. And at that moment, I justified it again. My kids are safe. They're not in DHS custody. And that was all I needed to go do what I do and live that life. And it continued on like that for another 3 years until I got pregnant again. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, it's crazy. And I know people who are listening, like, it, especially if they aren't an addict themselves, they're like, what are you thinking? We're not, you know, like, I wasn't. Mm-hmm. And I got pregnant with my youngest son. But before I had got pregnant with my youngest son, I met his dad, and his dad had, can I cuss? Is that okay?
Yeah.
He had "fuck the police" tattooed real big on his legs, like real big. I mean, like these big block letters. He was fresh out the penitentiary after doing like 11 years. And I was in love. Like, red flags for me. It's so, I can laugh now, because if you had all these red flags, those were not like caution signs. They were like, come here.
You know? Chaos. I love it. Chaos. Come here.
Yeah, like, if you don't have an ADC number, a federal registration number, like, I don't even have any interest in you. You know what I mean? Like, you're not, if Department of Corrections is not involved in your life, I'm just like, yeah, I can't do it. But he was fresh out the penitentiary and I was in love. And you talk about Bonnie and Clyde. Like, I thought that situation with the last one was bad. This one was worse. We were making more money than I had ever made in my life, doing things in my life that I never thought that I would do. You know what I mean? I never thought I would become that person. And we were together for a little while this time, probably like 2 years before I got pregnant with my youngest son. But the one thing about this relationship that was different than any relationship I had ever been in my life, it was one of the most physically, mentally, spiritually, emotionally abusive relationships I had ever encountered. When you're living that life, we talked about it, the paranoia, the delusion, we're making money. We think everybody's out to get us. He beat me like a man. And the sick part about it is, it wasn't until I got into recovery and I got into therapy and I really started working on myself that I realized, I think that was like a form of self-harm for me, right? Like, I had turned into this piece of shit mom who could not hold it together for my kids. And I think I was almost punishing myself. This is my karma. All these things that I'm experiencing in my life right now at this moment, it's my karma for all the shit that I've done in my life before, you know, and I took it. But not only that, though, when you're living that life, like, there is no just running away from each other. You know what I mean? Like, we're locked in because we have a lot of dirt going on that we can't just walk away from each other, you know?
Yeah.
But I got pregnant. Mm.
We call those trauma bonds.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Trauma bonds all day long.
Yeah, we were bonded. It was the tightest trauma bond I had ever experienced in my life. And so when I got pregnant, it was so much traumatic and so such a trauma bond that even when I got pregnant, he had gone to prison, and like, that should have been my out, right? Like, you don't have to deal with this anymore. He's in prison, that like, I'm seeking him out. You know what I mean? I'm in love with you. Like, I can't do this without you. Like, it was that much of a trauma bond that he wasn't even really trying to talk to me anymore. And I'm like, I'm here. Come get me. We get back together. And this is where the beginning of the end starts. So whenever he gets out, I think our son was like a year old, and he didn't even want to get high, right? Like, he was in prison. He wasn't doing any of that. He didn't want to get high, but I'm the one that got him high. And very quickly, we were right back into that life again, selling drugs, making money, and doing what we do. But it eventually started to come to a head. And March 3rd, so what, that'll be this Sunday, right? March 3rd of 2017, in my mind, I had no doubt that night that he was going to kill me. And that is the night that I decided to fight for my life, and I shot him twice. Yeah. Mm. I shot him twice, and our kid was in the house. And I think about it, like, the disease of addiction is so sick that my initial thought is not to go get my baby out of this room beside us after I shot his dad. What is it? My first thought is, let me get these drugs out of my house because the cops are coming. And when they come in here, like, I got enough to put me away for the rest of my life. I'm going through the house, and I'm not worried about calling the cops for him. I'm trying to get everything outside out of the house before they get called. And we had so many known domestic charges at that time that literally when I called the police and I was like, hey, I need help. Can you come here? And they were like, we don't have a police unit within 45 minutes away. And I was like, I shot him twice, and they were there 4 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? 4 minutes they were there. Once again, every ample opportunity in my life to do something different, but I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready. And I think that was another permission for me to go harder than I was going, because now I've defeated this monster. That's what I'm telling myself. But that was a very short-lived experience, because it was 4/20. So just a couple weeks after that happened, I was arrested with my youngest son in the car with a lot of drugs on me and a lot of money. And May 8th of that year, I was indicted on federal drug trafficking charges. So my clean date, by the grace of God, God willing, this May on the 9th, I will celebrate 7 years of continued sobriety, which so happens to be my youngest son's birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They took me to jail and indicted me the day before his birthday. And I was such an entitled asshole. I can never forget, like, when the feds came and I'm like, his birthday's tomorrow. they were like, we don't, what does that mean?
Think of the children.
Yeah, it's birthday tomorrow. You know what I mean? Just craziness. But yeah, so that's the day they took me to jail. And as addicts, right? Like, I had my relationship with the higher power or whatever was really non-existent. I am that person back then. Like, I'm a foxhole prayer kind of person, right? I go to jail. God, let me please get out of this. I promise I'm going to do something different. Or he would whoop me or whatever. And I'm like, please just let me make it through this one time, and I'm going to live a different life. But something about that day, when the feds come in your life, you're not walking away. And yeah. And I almost want to say, like, there was a sense of peace of me at that moment. Like, I was like, it's finally over. I could breathe a little bit. And I was super fortunate that they let my parents come pick my kid up both times. Like, that's another God moment. Like, I called and I'm like, can you come get this kid too? And they did.
Shout out to your parents, huh? Shout out to them. Holding it down for at least to get kids. It's more like a rescue. That's what I call it all the time. They rescued me from myself.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't stop. Finally, when you know it's over, it is a sense of freedom and relief. It's a surrender moment when you're finally just like, when you know.
Yeah.
That you're done. You're just done. Completed, defeated. Gift of desperation is in full effect.
Like, my soul was broken, you know, and I remember being in the back of that cop car, and I started crying, and you know, cops are assholes sometimes. And he's like, why are you crying now?
Yeah.
And I was like, and I started laughing. Like, I'm not crying. I even told him, I was like, I'm not even crying because I'm sad. Like, I feel relieved right now. You know what I mean? Like, when you live 17 years of your life ripping and running, and you know, anybody who's lived that life in the game, what comes with that, like, always looking behind your back, the violence, it's a lot. But I knew it was over. So they took me to jail. And I don't know about where you're from or whatever, but here in Arkansas, I think mostly it's because we have so drugs in this area for Arkansas, because it is such a small, and it's not really heavily populated. I think we have like a population of like 1.2 million in the entire state. There's not a lot, but there is so much drugs that is overran in this state alone that, like, they don't have any rooms in the jail facilities. So I sat in county for a while until I went to my plea and arraignment, And I remember, like, federal court hits different than any other court, right? Like, they start talking about your name versus the United States of America. And it always, like, related to, like, when you remember Snoopy and you had the teacher or whoever it was, and it was like, wah, 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 wah. And I'm in court, and that's what it sounds like to me. And I don't even know what they're saying at this point. And my attorney's like, he nudges me, and he's like, you want to go to rehab? And I was like, oh, yeah, let's go. Sure, let's go to rehab. And he was like, we're going straight from here to rehab. And I was like, can we stop at my house first? And he was like, no, like, no, you can't go home. I was like, okay, well, let's go to rehab, you know?
One last. Can we go by McDonald's at least? Come on.
Yeah, no. I was like, can we just stop somewhere? Like, I got to get, he said, you could call somebody to come get you some things. And I was like, fine. I was like, fine. So I get to rehab, and I'm still, you know, in that queen pin mode, right? Like, I'm fresh off the streets. I'm running shit. It's hard, right? Just because I was ready to surrender at that point does not mean that I have any tools under my belt to do anything different with myself. And I'm trying to fight people. I'm trying to call the shots in there. And I remember my therapist, and she was like, you're never going to make it. And I swear to you, as an addict, I was like, I'm going to show you.
You don't even know.
Like, I promise you, I'm going to show you. And it's so funny to me. She's one of my mentors now. And I tell her, I said, I really think that was a defining moment in my life, because she was like, you're never going to make it. Like, you'll be back. And I was like, no, I won't. You know, like, I'm not coming back. But that was finally where I started to surrender. And that's whenever they started, they used to do this thing called hospitals and institutions, and they would bring fellowships inside the facilities to the people who couldn't leave. And let me remind you, like, I was that addict who was like, you people have never been through what I've been through. I'm fixing to go to the feds. I had to shoot my kid's dad. And they were just looking at me like, this chick is crazy. But I would hear these women come in, and they would share their experience, strength, and hope, and they would tell their stories. And I can remember thinking, like, damn, like, I haven't been through half of this stuff some of these people have been through. And that is whenever the message of recovery started to plant the seed inside of me. Like, I was listening then. I'll never forget the other day that I was supposed to get out of treatment. You go to staffing and stuff. And so I thought I was going home. Why do I want to keep going back to this home? You know, like, this is the same home. I want to keep going back to it. I don't know. But I was like, going back home. And my federal probation officer, my pretrial officer, was there. And she was like, you're not going home. And I was like, where am I going? And she's like, you're going to sober living. And I was like, sober living? Because I didn't know what, this is all brand new to me. I'm like, what is sober living? And so they mandated me to sober living, where I would spend the next 6 months of my recovery really building a solid foundation for the rest of my life.
You shot your baby daddy. Mm-hmm. Did anything transpire from that as far as jail time or anything like that? All self-defense. And then also, is how long? So did the rehab, was that the sentence for the actual trafficking, for everything?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no.
Okay, here we go. Oh, no.
And I was talking about this just the other day to somebody. I swear to you, like, I have to look at these moments. Because a lot of times we, as addicts and stuff, when we're in recovery, like, we wait for these big aha moments to let us know that we're doing something right. But now I can look back at that, too, and know that was an aha moment, because I was under federal investigation whenever I shot him. And by all rights, I should have been charged with that gun. You know what I mean? Like, they should have charged me with the possession of a firearm and a furtherance of a drug trafficking crime, because I was under federal investigation. But they didn't. They didn't do it. I think they probably felt sorry for me. You know what I mean? Like, this girl has been getting the shit beat out of her for like 7 years, and they called it self-defense. It was only by the grace of God that one of the few times that I ever put the police in his life, and I had filed for a order of protection. That order of protection expired like 1 or 2 days after I shot him. So wow. It's looking back on it now, and I'm like, man, like, this all really happened. Like, it happened, boom, boom. Like, it was like designed to happen like this. So that order of protection was in place. So they called it self-defense. I went to rehab, but that's when I started pretrial. And pretrial is like the time that whenever you're waiting for your sentencing, they let you be out on pretrial, kind of like drug court, right? So like, I'd have to call every day to make sure I didn't have to go pee. And I was going to the federal building and peeing like 3 times a week. And I know in my mind, like, I'm waiting to go to prison, because at that point, like, there was no getting out of that. But that is where like life started to happen for me. I remember like I did the 90 and 90, like 90 meetings in 90 days. Like I got a sponsor and I started working steps. And I can remember like the first time I laughed, like in recovery, like in like belly laugh. So I'm living in sober living and I had a friend, Mike, who had got this scooter. And so when you know you're in sober living, like these little things happen. He's like, you want to ride the scooter? And I was like, yeah, let's go for a ride on the scooter. But we're bigger, right? So we're on this scooter going up hills and we get up to this hill and the scooter does not want to go. He's like, you got to get off and you got to push me. And I'm like, okay. So I'm pushing him up this hill and we're laughing so hard. Like we're about to break this scooter. And I can remember thinking like, why did I spend so many years of my life miserable? You know what I mean? Like I was laughing so hard that like I'm crying and I was happy. Like I was those cliches. I was happy, joyous and free. And I remember just riding around this town downtown with him and just crying on the back of the scooter and not even understanding like what's going on inside of me. But I was happy. I was a mom again. My mom, gosh, she's a soldier. You know what I mean? Like she was a soldier, man. And she had my kids, but she allowed me to be in their lives when I was able to go see them and have them on the weekends and stuff. And this whole time I'm still fighting these charges, but I was very blessed. I had the opportunity to start working in treatment the very first time I ever worked in treatment. And I started working at a detox facility here in Little Rock. And that's when I got to start sharing the message a lot more. I don't know if you guys have peer recovery support specialists where you're from.
Yep, sure do.
So it was 2018, and that is the year that the movement, the peer movement, moved through the state of Arkansas. And I was in the first round of people who became peer recovery support specialists in the state. Now I'm going back into these same jails and these same facilities that used to house me, bringing the message of recovery to these people, working with these people, teaching groups to these people. I had the opportunity to work and do a lot of work with the Arkansas Drug Director's Office here and still waiting to go to prison. And whenever you start living a life like that, so many people were like, no, you're not going to go to prison. You're not going to go to prison. And I had resigned in my mind, like I knew I was going to prison. I knew I was going. But once again, here's another God shot. Trump was in office and it was the year that they passed the First Step Act into legislation. I don't know if you know anything about that or what that is. It is the biggest criminal justice reform act on the federal level that we have seen in our lifetimes, which means that like first time nonviolent offenders, it gave them a sentencing variance, which means that they could go below their mandatory minimum and not have to do the mandatory like 85% or, you know, what your guidelines call for. And so I was sentenced under the First Step Act. And when I should have probably got a 10-year sentence, I was sentenced to the Federal Bureau of Prisons for 36 months. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Those little God moments, you know, and it's amazing when we're doing the right thing, how it shows up strong, right? Strong. It shows up. Shows all out. It's about time. Here, I'll give you a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. It was amazing, like to walk into federal court and have letters from like legislators, have letters from different lawyers and rehab people that I worked for who came and testified on my behalf. One of my best friends, Jimmy McGill, I don't know if you know who that is or not.
I do.
Yeah. Jimmy and I used to run the streets together. We've been friends for 20 years. And he is the one who started the peer recovery support services in Arkansas. So he came to my federal court hearing and he spoke on my behalf. And it was just, that court hearing was probably one of the most emotional court hearings I'd ever been in my life. And that judge was like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to send you to prison. We have a minimum amount of time that you have to do it. And so I went to prison, which was pre-COVID. I got to drive myself to federal prison. Like, who does that? You know what I mean? Like, they were like, hey, you're going to federal prison in Illinois. Can you get yourself there? And I was like, yeah, yeah, I can do that. Yeah.
Where'd your car go?
I made sure to get myself there. My sponsor took me. You know.
Yeah. So you got sentenced to 3 years. And then that video was recorded right after you got out of that, evidently. Yeah. So tell me, what is it like now? What is life like? Give me an after prison, because we all know what prison's like, you know? But it's, I guess, brush on it about what it's like being clean and sober in prison. And then let's talk about the after now, up the video, all that.
So, you know, a lot of people don't get to say that. Like, I went to prison clean and I came home clean. And you know, what's crazy about federal prison is, like, I think truly, like, you find your people anywhere. And so when I got to federal prison, I had found like two other girls whose stories were so similar to mine. And anybody that knows anything about recovery in prison, there's not a lot of it. You know what I mean? Like, you have programming and then you have church and then you have just whatever. But we started a meeting called From the Inside Out inside of prison. And that's how I was able really to maintain like my sobriety. But I finally got to come home. I went through prison during COVID, one of the most trying times in my life, right? Like, we were locked down 24/7. And when it, once again, it was a really that like true testimony of like, you got to do this, man. You got to come home clean. Anybody that knows anything about the federal system. So like whenever you go to federal prison, you don't get to just go home. They make you go to a federal halfway house. And I had been at the halfway house for probably like a month before my kids didn't even know I was home, you know? So I was at a federal prison camp. And so like anytime my little baby, like he was just learning to read. And so like when he would see like the mail come in, it said camp, somehow he had it that I was at space camp. Like that's where he thought I was.
Whatever works.
Yeah. So like, whatever, we just rolled with it. We were, my daughter knew where I was at. And
you're space cadets. So there's that.
I would do FaceTime with him and they would see like the metal bunks and stuff. And they were like, he's like, is that like the spaceship? And I'm like, yeah, it's fine. But the day I got to finally come home and they approved my pass to come home, I was nervous. I was nervous and I was scared. And my kid's dad was the one that was recording. And that is not at all the reaction that I thought that they were going to have, especially my daughter. Like, I thought they were just going to be like, yeah, she's home. But when they opened that door and she broke down the way that she did, like, I still can't watch it to this day. We're talking almost 7 years later, and I watch it and it still, it gets me to this day, watching how emotional she was. But that's what started my TikTok career. Like that video was what started it. Post this video.
It started your TikTok career. Oh gosh.
Yeah. I didn't even know what TikTok was. That was a thing that happened while I was in prison. So everybody's like, TikTok. And I'm like, what is that? But like I said, I've had this prior 4 years of being an advocate for recovery. Like, I had to really do some deep soul searching whenever I posted that video because it was a very vulnerable moment. And I asked her, I'm like, are you okay with me posting it? And she was like, yeah. Not ever thinking that I was going to get the attention that it got. And that's all she wrote. And then life has been so good ever since.
I appreciate you reaching out. What an amazing story. You know, I was a little shocked. When we hear stories, it's like some of those ones, it's just, like, oh, wow. I'd like, you had me. I was like, wow, I didn't expect that. And but it's so cool to hear the success stories. I think that's what motivates me to keep going and doing this advocacy work and doing the, because it's hard at times. It's very stressful at times, you know, emotionally, but it's so rewarding in the same aspect. And thank you for reaching out to us. And I'm sure that, I'm sure Jimmy's the one that said, hey, this is your video, maybe?
Like that, yeah, it wasn't even him. That's why we do what we do today, right? I work in a treatment facility called Natural State Recovery Centers. I'm the outpatient coordinator, chaos coordinator, you know?
Chaos, God, thank you for pointing that out. I appreciate you.
I get to be that person today that shows these people that we can and we do recover. You know what I mean? You hear my story and I tell my story a lot and they're like, it sounds like a movie. And I'm like, listen, that just goes to show you, man. Like, if I can get clean, anybody can get clean. Like, we don't have to keep continuing to live in this chaos, man. There is hope in a world that feels hopeless.
That's it. We're going to end on that. Thank you so much, Mary Beth. I appreciate you so much for coming on here and sharing.
Oh, thank you.